You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And interesting, a couple of new surveys out. A new CBS News New York Times poll reveals that an overwhelming majority, 66% of Americans, believe that additional terrorist attacks are likely in the United States in the coming months. And in another poll from Farley Dickinson University, 44% of self-described Republican voters believe that, quote, an armed revolution might be necessary to protect our liberties, end quote. Who should we worry about more, the Republicans or the Muslims? Richard Perle might know, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy, Reagan Administration, 1981 to 87, currently President Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Pentagon Policy Advisor to the Bush Administration until 2004, AEI.org is the website for the American Enterprise Institute. Richard Perle, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
You are promoting or talking about this the third jihad, this the Clarion Project's new film, Radical Islam's Vision for America. Tell me about this.
Well, it's a really interesting, packed with information documentary that deals with the effort by radical Islamists to propagate the vision of an Islamic universe and to do so in the United States. And when we think about these acts of terror and are reluctant to say that they have a source, an ideological source, I think we prevent ourselves from coming up with strategies for dealing with it. So it's an important documentary. The public needs to understand what the inspiration for these acts of terror really is.
Would it not be reasonable to say that back in the, the 30s or the 40s, when the king of Saudi Arabia made the deal with Mr. Waha, or the founder of Wahhabism, I'm sure you know the details of this better than I, that particular radical strain of Islam, you know, up until that point, Islam had been far less, radical. And for the fact of the matter is, I mean, there's over a billion Muslims in the world. The vast majority of them just want to raise their kids and, you know, have a job and, you know, conduct themselves fine. But, that, you know, we and Saudi Arabia kind of made a deal with the devil, and that has not produced the best results for us.
Well, I certainly agree with that. What happened, of course, was the feudal state of Saudi Arabia was looking for legitimacy, and so it did a deal with an extremist radical cleric, Wahhab, and the Wahhabi sect, unfortunately, with the wealth of Saudi Arabia behind it, has been propagating this extremist vision all over the world. It supports and sponsors thousands of schools, madrasas as they're called, which really don't teach much more than this radical Islamist vision. You find a lot of them in Pakistan, for example.
Yeah. I'm familiar with this. And, you know, and literally school books in Saudi Arabia that say that, you know, Jews use the blood of Muslims to make matzah.
What makes it worse, of course, is that it reaches into the United States. Tremendous amounts of money flow from the Wahhabi institutions to schools and mosques in the U.S.
So given that this, you know, so much of this is coming out of Saudi Arabia, and you know, we have to keep in mind that it was, 14 of the hijackers in 9/11 were Saudis. It just like seems like the source of all this stuff, and yet we're flying the Bin Laden family out of the country when the rest of the country is shut down after 9/11.
I think we have failed to understand how Saudi Arabia deals with us in the world, and therefore how we should deal with them. And the issue has been confused in recent years because the Saudis have had their own internal terrorist problem, and they've cracked down on it, which has led some people wrongly to conclude that they have somehow shifted sides. The fact is, while they're tough on their own terrorists internally, they're quite happy to see the extremists operate outside Saudi Arabia.
Oh, they're promoting Wahhabism all around the world, and we're promoting them by buying their oil. You know, which gets back to, I mean, you could argue that this goes back to when Churchill decided to take the British Navy off coal and put it on oil, even though England had no oil. And you know, we got in bed with him on that, and all of a sudden, you know, we had an oil-based economy around the world, and suddenly the British, in particular, were very interested in Saudi Arabia, and then we got into that one. I mean, there's just all these pieces of this thing, but
life is full of irony.
It really is. It really is. Meanwhile, we've got. I mean, you know, I think most Americans have some concern about Islamic terrorism, although the odds of any of us being killed by a Muslim terrorist, first of all, are lower. We just here in Washington, D.C. yesterday, we had a cab driver who was an American in the Army Reserves who had served in Iraq, who was Muslim, cab driver. And a guy got in his cab, and they've got the video from the cab cam, you know. And for 11 minutes, this guy just beat the crap out of this cab driver because he was Muslim. The cab driver was an American. He was an American soldier, and now making a living driving a cab. I think, you know, Muslims are more at risk in the United States, it seems, than we are from the Muslims. You're more likely to die slipping in the bathtub than you are to die in a terrorist attack. Aren't we just like going hysterical here about something that we should be treating in a more rational way?
I certainly agree we should be treating it in a more rational way. But unfortunately, what happens is the administration and many political figures are reluctant to talk about it out of a fear that it will somehow inflame anti-Muslim passions. If we talk about the much narrower but important issue of the Wahhabi influence in the world and increasingly in the United States, what we need to do is isolate the source of the problem. It's not all Muslims. It's not Islam as such. It is a very narrow radical strain, and we need to come to grips with that.
I don't disagree. It's like the people who suggest that all Christians are terrorists because there's an entire network of Christians who were supporting Eric Rudolph when he bombed the Olympics in Atlanta,
right.
and several of the other abortion clinic bombers. I mean, there's literally a network of Christians in the United States who support these guys and you know, will hide them in things. And so we've got our own Wahhabists within Christianity in the United States. It's a much smaller number, and they're nowhere near as well-funded. They don't have a petro state behind them. But to color all Christians that way is just as absurd as to color all Muslims, with the Wahhabi perspective. We have just a minute left. I'm curious your thoughts on 44% of Republicans think that it's appropriate to take up arms against the government of the United States of America. Have we gone nuts?
Yeah. Yes, I think we have. There are lots of problems in the government, but none of them rise to the level that we should be taking up arms, that's for sure.
Where is this coming from?
I think there's mounting frustration, a sense on the part of many conservatives that they are unable to influence government policy, that between the Democrats and the Republicans who are unwilling to make a revolution, they feel they have no means of expression.
Interesting conversation. Richard Perle, former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. Sir, thank you so much for being with us today.
All the best. It's always a pleasure.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, do you think that the Republicans are going to mount an armed revolution? Didn't they try that in 1860 or 61? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So here we go. I mean, first of all, it would be such a it would be so easy to say to somebody like Richard Perle or anybody else who was an advocate for the Iraq War, you know, you guys all ought to be in jail or something like that, prosecute, or you were just wrong. But I think that there actually is a conversation that needs to be had in the United States about radicalism in all religions. Bill Maher begins this about religion in general. I think we need to drill it a layer deeper and look at the people who are willing to use violence and the people who support them. I mean, Eric Rudolph was on the run for years while Richard Jewell was taking the hit for bombing the Olympics in Atlanta. I lived in Atlanta at the time. I remember it really, really well. And there is a network of people out there who will support, who will hide, who will fund people who murder abortion doctors. But that doesn't mean that people who are opposed to abortion are terrorists. That doesn't mean that Christians, regardless of how they feel about abortion, are terrorists. It means that there is a small cult within the Christian religion of people who are willing to engage in terror. And similarly, there is a small cult within the Muslim religion that is willing to engage in terror, and that's a tragedy, and it's something that we need to address, we need to speak honestly about. And not demagogue it like, you know, Michelle Malkin. I mean, the fact of the matter is there were several hundred attacks this last year on Muslims in the United States because they were Muslims. More Muslims have been attacked in the United States than Americans have been attacked by terrorists because we're hysterical about this. If there's anybody we should be seriously taking on, it's the best friends of the Bush family, the Saudis. But you're not going to hear much conversation about that. You're never going to hear about that on Fox so-called news because the second largest stockholder in Fox so-called news is a Saudi citizen. And you're never going to hear, you know, conversation about that basically in the mainstream or corporate media because it requires a little bit of thought. And since the end of the Fairness Doctrine, we don't have news anymore. We have infotainment and, you know, serious stuff. So we have that. And then at the same time, and I raised this with Richard Perle. Maybe I should have called him Monsieur Perle. Apparently he has a vacation home in France. In any case, I raised this with him, you know, Farley Dickinson University, 44% of self-described Republican voters agree with this statement, quote, an armed revolution might be necessary to protect our liberties, end quote. Really? I mean, this is disturbing. 18% of Democrats think an armed revolution might be necessary. 44% of Republicans, 27% of independents. Really? I get these calls. People going, oh, yeah, I've got to have my gun to take on the government. And I'm like, it's our government. We started it. I'm frankly more frightened by these armed Republicans who think that they need to go kill a bureaucrat. What was the guy's name who flew the airplane into the IRS building about a decade ago? Yeah, Joe Stack. That's right, Joe Stack. Thank you, Louise. Joe Stack, you know, he was like, he had had it up to here. His company was going bankrupt. He was a failed entrepreneur. And he was behind in his taxes. So what does he decide to do? He decides to fly an airplane he's going to declare violent revolution against the United States. Tim McVeigh, violent revolution against the United States. Come on. Do we really have to start? Haven't we already tried this? You know, I've been sharing with you for years this ongoing conversation that my wife and I have. Louise is of the opinion that Abe Lincoln, you know, when Robert E. Lee said, okay, that's it, we're seceding. In fact, actually, I mean, that was the violent beginning of it. I mean, but by the time when Lincoln was elected, I think maybe one or two states had seceded or announced their intention to. But the election was in November of 1860. By March of 61, when he was inaugurated, there was, what, 6, 8, 10, something like that. It was a bunch of states that had actually taken the step of secession. And, you know, boom. And Louise is of the opinion that Lincoln should have just said, okay, see you later. Just think where we'd be right now today. If all the red states, the taker states, the ones who take more in federal dollars than they give, the ones that have the highest levels of poverty, the ones that we support, if the taker states simply seceded and called themselves the Confederate States of America, and if the maker states, where the majority of people would like to have national single-payer health care systems, and dial back on the government spending and no more private prisons and have free public education all the way up to MD or PhD for everybody, the maker states, the northern states, the coastal states, you know, continue to be the United States of America and fulfilled the vision of the Enlightenment that Thomas Jefferson was arguably the most articulate spokesperson in history for. I'd like to think, personally, now I disagree with Louise. I don't, you know, I'm not sure that, you know, I think in retrospect, if Lincoln had known what would have happened, he may well have done it differently. He did think the Civil War would be over in a matter of weeks, but I still think we can make it as a country. But apparently Republicans don't.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
44%? We got to take a gun and shoot somebody who works for the government? That could be your next door neighbor. Really? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And RJ in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. Hey, RJ, what's up?
Hey, I didn't know you knew where I lived. I was laughing when you said Fox. What did you call Fox News?
Fox so-called news.
Fox so-called news. I always consider the news, the N-E-W-S, as new entertainment without substance.
That's a great acronym.
That's what I call it, because it's not news. It's just some other event, some new entertainment.
Yeah. I would have no problem with Fox if they just called themselves Fox. Or if they call themselves Fox Opinion or the Fox Program or something like that. But when they try to present what they're doing as news and then on top of that insult us by suggesting that it's fair and balanced, eyes cross.
Because they're kind of sly like a fox.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay.
Great job. I love your
show. Well, thank you very much. Very well said. Steve in Helotes, Texas. Am I saying that right, Steve?
Actually, San Antonio, Texas. Helotes.
Oh, okay.
Right outside of it. But yeah.
Okay. So, what's up? Says you disagree with me. What do you? How so?
Well, I partly agree with you in that Islam is more of a problem in the Middle East and on that area. But I feel like it is at the bottom of it all religious dogmatism that's leading this. If you look at the Quran, it has explicit writings about. About jihad, about martyrdom. About,
so does the Bible.
You know, sure, but
in fact, we celebrate Jesus, who was tortured and murdered on the cross.
Sure, but at this point in time,
talk about martyrdom.
Islam is more violent than is Christianity. I mean, if we look at over history, sure, Christianity had its violent times, but we have to face.
I'm not disagreeing with you, Steve. And the point and that I wanted to bring out this conversation with Richard Pearl, and I'm glad we were able to do it in a rational way rather than my just screaming at him that he was a war criminal and him screaming at me that I was a crazy liberal, which is the other way the conversation probably would have gone, is that the king of Saudi Arabia, most people don't know this history, and I encourage you to look it up, the history of Wahhabism. In the first half of the 20th century, the first third of the 20th century, Islam was really a very kind of quiet and almost secular religion. The fundamentalists in Islam were very, very rare. And this fundamentalist sect, you know, as when Saudi Arabia, when Churchill decided to go use oil to fuel the British Navy rather than coal, and the principal source of that oil was going to be Saudi Arabia, we had to pick out of all the various Saudi tribes one group to put in charge of the whole country so that they would sell the oil to us. And we picked the guys who are now the Saudi royal family. And the biggest problem that they had was that there was this preacher, Mr. Waha, or whatever his name was, who was the founder of this sect called Wahhabism, and he was sort of the Jerry Falwell of his time, if Jerry Falwell was sanctioned firebombing people. I don't think he ever did, but you get my point. He was the most, well-known, outspoken, but he was also a radical, and he believed that the Quran sanctioned killing. And so Wahhabism began to grow in Saudi Arabia in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and then they began to export it and to other countries. And it is that strain of Wahhabism that has actually infected Chechnya. It's infected, it's all around the world. It's not Islam. It's a sect within Islam, just like it's not Christianity that's putting together support networks to hand off from one person to another, people like Eric Rudolph, or people who murder abortion doctors. It's not the religion. It's the cult within the religion. And we need to be calling that out. And, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, I don't care. We need to be calling that out. And we need to be empowering the rational Muslims. And I think that with drone strikes, we're not empowering the rational Muslims, even if we may be killing a few Wahhabists, because the Al-Qaeda is an offshoot of Wahhabism, by the way. One of the probably the most famous Wahhabist in the world was Osama bin Laden. And we're not empowering the moderates with drone strikes. We're not empowering the moderates by taking down secular governments in the Middle East. We're not empowering the Wahhabists by invading and bombing and blanketing with depleted uranium a country that represented no threat to us whatsoever. Two countries, actually, that represented no threat to us whatsoever, Iraq and Afghanistan. We are empowering the crazies. We're giving them the best gift that they ever could have asked for, and we need to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Am I making sense?
And here's some statistics, though, that really kind of trouble me about Islam in general. There were polls done in Great Britain, so asking, the Islamic population in Great Britain about, would you support violence to defend Islam?
Yeah.
And about 44%, 45%, said yes.
Yeah, I remember when that poll came out about three or four years ago. There are a number of mitigating circumstances on that poll. Just like I'm guessing there are mitigating circumstances of this poll that came out yesterday, saying that 44% of American Republicans believe that we should take up arms and kill police officers, first responders, firemen, the army. I mean, there's something weird going on here. And we all just need to take a deep breath and say, okay, who's really killing us? And the people really killing us are the tobacco industry, the fast food industry, the oil industry, the coal industry. You can't even fish in the waters of the United States anymore without getting mercury in your food, and damaging your children's and grandchildren neurological systems. We are we're being killed by crazed capitalists, and I'd say more than anything else, by crazed capitalists, people who would rather make a buck and have 500,000 people a year die from tobacco than go find a decent way to make a living. These are the real terrorists in the United States, or the NRA, the gun manufacturers. Look at how much money. I mean, Roy Blunt in Missouri took $1,608,517 from the NRA. They spent a total of $8 million on Congress. Rob Portman took over $1 million from them, $1.3 million. Ron Johnson took $1.1 million from them. John Boozman took $896,000 from them. Saxby Chambliss, $395,000. I mean, you know, these 45 senators who blocked an effort to simply close the gun show loophole. You know, I'm not going to, you know, demagogue the thing and exaggerate and call them terrorists, but I will call them stupid, and I will call them bought off, and I will say that what they're doing is fundamentally un-American. And I think that we need, you know, we need to get our priorities straight, and if we're going to be afraid of something, we need to get our fears straight. Thanks for the call. Charles in Indian Trail, North Carolina. Hey, Charles.
Hey, Tom, you talked me into it. I have no other choice now.
I can't hear you, Charles. You're on a speakerphone. You're sounding so faint.
No.
Maybe, what are you using, a Bluetooth in a car or something?
Yes, I am. I'm in my truck.
Okay, well, just talk loud. Go for it, Charles.
Okay. Well, you talked me into it, Tom. I'm going to run out to the next gun show and get myself as many guns as possible.
Okay.
I've got to protect my government from these deranged crazies.
Okay. I got it. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thank you, Charles. Excellent. Very, very funny. Very good call. Damien in Manorville, New York. Hey, Damien, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Listen, I just got to correct you on a couple of things. And not that I know more than you. I'm a big fan of yours, even though I'm a little right to you in a lot of ways. But, you know, I'm with you on a lot of other things. But this thing, you know, you comparing Christian, so-called Christians who are, you know, murdering abortion doctors to fundamentalist Muslims.
I would say they are so-called Muslims
people.
Because Islam teaches peace. Islam does not teach.
No. Listen, Tom, this is what I'm trying to call you for. And you must understand, and a lot of people do, it's peaceful if you comply with them. That's the whole point. And now, look, Christ says this.
Damien, what is your credential to speak authoritatively about Islam?
I have studied both. Okay, now if you just listen to me
where?
For a moment, through various sources
on the internet.
Just listen for a moment. No, not at all. I have three Korans. I can speak a little bit of Arabic, but if you just listen for a moment, Christ says very clearly, do not lift a sword in my name. So when someone is killing an abortion doctor because they think that's the right thing to do, you have to go back to the source. If you're a Christian, what does Christ say? Christ says that is not a true Christian.
Right. Well, that's what he said to Peter, yeah.
What does the Quran say? It says this very explicitly. You cannot misinterpret this. It says, do not befriend the Jew or the Christian, for they are your enemy. Now, what happens is this. This is at the end of the Quran. The Quran in the beginning calls the Jews and the Christians the people of the book, meaning that they are one and the same with the Muslims.
Yeah.
However, this is for Muhammad to woo.
Damien, it doesn't much matter what it says in either book. What matters is the people who are interpreting it and the way they're interpreting it. That's what matters. I mean, like I said, you can go back and read the book of Joshua and you can turn Christianity or Judaism into something really, really nasty. And I don't think most people want to do that. And the same thing with Islam.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But at its core, these are all religions that, at their core, preach peace. And it's the crazy sects we need to be calling out, not the religions. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Although, you know, I will tell you right up front, there's a fair amount of opinion in here, too. We are fair and slightly unbalanced. Okay. Julie in Palatine, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Julie, what's up?
Hi. Wow, you're talking about Islam, you're talking about people with their guns. I wanted to first say that a lot of these radicalized young people who are Islamic, I know like in France, they've become radicalized because, you know, their parents came over like to Paris or whatever to get jobs and to have a better life.
Right.
And they live in like these high-rise slums and the kids don't have jobs. so that somehow they listen to a couple of these weird, you know,
imams, preachers, imams.
The Islamic preachers, and that's when they become radicalized. They're bored.
Yeah.
They've got nothing else to do. They hate their country. They live in a slum, and this is why they do that, I think.
Now, I don't disagree with you. I think that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt only had half the equation when he said that the best welfare program is a job. It's also the best way to make a society, a culture work, is for everybody to have a decent paying job. So, you know, work that's meaningful to them and work for which they're appropriately compensated. And you're right. In particularly across Europe, this, when I lived in Germany, I mean, this is the problem Germany has with, and by problem, I mean, it's a problem that the ethnic Germans have and are going to have to figure out what to do about, which is after World War II, most of the men were dead. They were in Hitler's army. I mean, Hitler, by the end of the army, he was recruiting 12-year-olds. And most of the men were dead, and they needed to rebuild their country. And so they invited all these guys from Turkey to come in. They call them Gastarbeiters, which is guest workers in German. And they're, those people, this was in the 40s, and those people now, you know, their children have had children and have had children. And so now you've got second, third, fourth generation. Mom was born in Germany. Grandmother was born in Germany. It was great-grandmother who came to Germany to work. And now the ethnic German population has repopulated itself. And there isn't that much work for the Gastarbeiters anymore. They're widely discriminated against, and they're still not able to get German citizenship because they don't have a law like they don't have like the 14th Amendment that we have, where if you happen to be born there, you're a citizen. And so there's this huge debate going on in Germany about what to do about the Gastarbeiters. And meanwhile, you know, the Gastarbeiter population, these Turks, many of whom are Muslim, most of them are Muslim, are becoming increasingly radicalized because they're being screwed and they know it. And it's like the more you see these kinds of situations, the more you get it, that it's not just some simple thing about, you know, and they hate us for our freedoms. In fact, that is not even the smallest piece of it. That is not even any piece of it. Julie, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Very well said. Bob in Kansas City, Missouri. Hey, Bob, you're a professor of religious studies, really?
Yes, I am. Actually, Professor Emeritus. I just retired from the University of Kansas in 2010.
Well, good on you.
I'm a historian of religion. Yeah. I wrote a book called When Religion is an Addiction. I'm not on to plug myself. But I just want to say I appreciate how your taking is on this, because I really believe that blaming of religion is sort of an easy out. Say it's Islam's fault or Christianity's fault, so that we don't have to look into the kinds of things you look at, the history, the economics, how we've treated people, and so on. So I really think that this is sort of used as an easy out. Well, it's Islam's fault. And so, because the same religions are used, as you're pointing out, for all kinds of things. I mean, it's like saying it's Christianity's fault, but then you have Martin Luther King using the same Bible, the same book, the same text, the same history, the same traditions, but using it in a totally different way.
Yes.
So I really think I just want to support what you're saying, but I want to say that's my view, is that this is a way to not deal with the history, the economics, and all of our other issues by blaming religion in general. So.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, I think that this whole idea of looking for the deeper cause, in Islam, the issue of Wahhabism in the United States, you know, if you've heard the program a lot, you've probably heard me rant a lot about the Supreme Court and how we have this constitutional monarchy here. I am of the opinion, I may well be wrong on this, and I would love to have a debate with somebody about it who, you know, is fairly well educated on the topic. But the person who put me onto this actually was Phyllis Schlafly on this program. And essentially what she said, and this was a number of years ago, she agrees with me, by the way, that the Supreme Court has overstepped their power and has been since 1803. As a liberal, I find it very weird when Phyllis Schlafly and Newt Gingrich agree with me on anything, but they agree with me on this. And she said that had the abortion, you know, that in Roe v. Wade, the court actually created law because they defined three separate trimesters and different rules for each trimester. Now, that's something that should be done by a legislature, not by a court. Courts shouldn't be making laws. and courts should be deciding who wins and who loses in a case where people litigate against each other. I mean, that's, you know, at least an appeals court.
Mm-hmm.
And her point, and I think that there's some truth to it, is that if the Supreme Court had not decided Roe v. Wade, but instead another few years had gone by, and I realize, you know, the terrible thing, you know, the women dying from coat hanger abortions and whatnot, but still, a couple more years had gone by and a legislative process had made abortion legal in the United States and had defined or allowed individual states to define, as the case may be, how they were going to regulate it and, you know, when life begins and when, you know, what the terms on that, you wouldn't have people killing abortion doctors because it would have been something that we all collectively did. In other words, the original sin was the Supreme Court, just like the original sin was the Wahhabists. So I don't know. It's just,
yeah, I don't know if I would agree with that, because I think that if it had been legislatively, there would be an excuse, and the politics and the issues and everything would probably use that in the same way they're using the Civil Rights Act or affirmative action and so on.
You're probably right.
So I'm not sure.
You're probably right. Although the Civil Rights Act, you know, some people say you could track that back to Brown v. Board, but no, you're probably right, Bob. I think I'm overstating it. But and Shane tells me, Bob, do you have a copy of Unequal Protection, my book on the Supreme Court?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, you're going to get a copy. We're going to send you a free autographed copy. You're our book winner of the day. I'm going to put you on hold. Bob is on line 5, Danielle, and Bob in Kansas City, Missouri, and I'll send you an autographed copy courtesy of Stamps.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Banana Republic in North Carolina. GOP committee chair approves bill to gut clean energy without even counting the votes. Amazing. Amazing. Headline over at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog. It's funny, one of the people in our chat room, CF Dem, says, I'm guessing he's in like Mississippi or something. He says, if Lincoln had told the seceding states goodbye, we'd probably have the equivalent of North Korea down here. Yeah. You know, last Tuesday, or this Tuesday, Brandon from Missouri called into this show and asked me, how big do I think government should be? He says, what is the liberal end goal as far as the size of government? And while I answered him at the time when I took that call, and in fact, you can watch the clip of it on our YouTube channel over at youtube.com/Tom Hartman. There's a link to it off TomHartman.com. I want to take a little more time to answer that question right here and now, because it seems to be on the mind of a lot of people who think they're conservatives or libertarians, and 44% of them even think that our government is so big that they want to pick up a gun and kill somebody. So how big do I want our government to be? I would like our government to be big enough that it can successfully stop Big Pharma from charging us 5 times the price that other countries, people in other countries pay for pharmaceuticals. Like Lipitor. Now, I'm not a big fan of Lipitor. I don't use it. In fact, I've heard it can have pretty nasty side effects. But in New Zealand, a prescription for Lipitor costs on average $6. In South Africa and Spain, $11 and $13. But here in the United States, a prescription of Lipitor costs on average $100. Now, if that is a drug that people actually do need and it does actually save their lives, I think that's outrageous. Our government needs to be big enough so it can reel in profiteering pharmaceutical companies and make medications affordable for all Americans. I mean, basically, you have a choice. Do you want big government or you want big corporations? Because something is going to occupy that space. I want our government to be big enough that it can regulate factories and fertilizer plants instead of letting them explode and kill people like what we saw in West Texas. you know, Americans who have a job, they should be able to go to work knowing that they're going to be safe and that all the precautions that need to be taken have been taken. And our government's apparently not big enough to do that. Our government needs to be big enough to send banksters to jail who caused this country to collapse in 2008. You know, like Iceland did. I think the people like J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon and Goldman Sachs' Lloyd Blankfein have caused real and lasting damage to the American economy and society shouldn't just get off with a slap on the wrist. The United States government needs to be big enough to successfully regulate the banks and to hold Wall Street cronies accountable for their negligent or criminal actions so that they can't be repeated again and again like they're doing right now. $700 trillion, according to the New York Times yesterday, $700 trillion in unregulated derivatives. Remember, the GDP of the world is $65 trillion. GDP of the United States, $15 trillion. $700 trillion that the banks have created out of nothing, out of thin air. There's not $700 trillion worth of gold backing it up. There's not $700 trillion worth of oil backing it. There's $700 trillion worth of bets. And when those bets go south, you know what the banks are going to do? They're going to say to you and me, when you deposited your money with us, you didn't actually, it became our money, and we're just going to keep it. And they're going to say to our government, give us a bunch of money, or we will bring the economy to its knees. I mean, they just did the former in Cyprus, and they did the latter in the United States back in 2008. We need a government big enough to break up the big banks. We need a government big enough to break up the giant monopolies, the transnational corporations, and instead encourage the growth. We need a government big enough to encourage the growth of small businesses on Main Street. And in the process of breaking up the monopolies, the government needs to be big enough to bring back good-paying jobs home to America, instead of allowing giant corporations to outsource them to third world countries where they have what Pope Francis correctly called slaves as their laborers. Our government needs to be big enough to provide quality and affordable health care for all Americans. It needs to be big enough to keep the social safety net intact so that when Americans fall down, they're able to get back up, dust themselves off, and begin trying to live the American dream once again. The American government needs to be big enough so that it can provide a quality, affordable education for everyone, so that students who attend college don't graduate with mountains of student loan debt that will haunt them for much of the rest of their adult lives. Our government needs to be big enough to educate all Americans about the perils of climate change and global warming and be able to put into the work that it takes to curb climate change and prevent a total environmental catastrophe, because I think we're facing one. And part of that work includes breaking America's toxic addiction to fossil fuels. And instead, we need a government big enough to invest heavily in clean and green energies of the future, like wind and solar. And finally, the United States government needs to be big enough to bring back the Fairness Doctrine, the policy introduced in 1949 by the FCC that required broadcast news channels to present real news in an honest, fair, and balanced way. Americans deserve real facts and real news, not constant streams of misinformation and opinions and fluff disguised as news. Bottom line here, our government is not big enough. It's not big enough to bring down the cost of prescription medication. It's not big enough to ensure that all Americans have access to affordable education and affordable health care. It's not big enough to throw banksters in jail or to stop corporations from outsourcing jobs. Pentagon's big enough. Pentagon, you can make a little smaller. That's fine with me. We don't need 700 military bases around the world. But that's on the government side. On the other hand, I do not want our government to be playing in the private sector, the means of production and distribution. I want my jeans and my computer and my car, I don't own one now, but I used to be made by private companies. I want every American to be able to become an entrepreneur. I've been an entrepreneur my entire life. I have probably spent, you know, the roughly 10 years I spent doing radio, maybe three of that I was doing that full time. And then on top of that, I worked for RCA as an engineer for 1 year, a little less than a year, actually, when Louise was pregnant with our first child so we could get health insurance. And I'm pretty sure that that's it, that the rest of my life I've worked for myself. I work for myself now. I've always been an entrepreneur. I would like other Americans to be able to. I want people to be able to form corporations and cooperatives and make goods and services that the rest of us want. Government should keep itself to two simple areas, protecting and running the commons and regulating capitalism so it doesn't destroy us. And in my opinion, our commons doesn't just include the police and fire and army, but includes education and health care. But that's it. And that's enough, by the way. The framers of the Constitution explicitly said in the preamble that they were creating it to promote the general welfare. In Article 1, Section 8, they gave Congress the power to raise taxes and spend money to promote the general welfare. And in my mind, that means to build, protect, and run the commons and keep us safe from corporate and fat cat predators. So how big should our government be? That's big enough. You want a percentage? You want a number? Well, here in the United States, we're about 21% of GDP. In Canada, it's around 45. Most of Europe, it's around 50. In Scandinavia, it's around 60. I think somewhere in there, in between those numbers, is a reasonable size.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And if we shrank our military a little bit and expanded our social safety net a whole lot, we'd be a much better country. Welcome back, fair and only slightly unbalanced, helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman with you. Natalie, listening on KABQ in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Natalie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was calling to comment on something that you said earlier in the program about the southern states seceding and kind of looking in hindsight that, you know, maybe Lincoln should have let them go. And I don't necessarily disagree with that sentiment, but having lived my entire life in a southern state that probably would have been part of the Confederacy eventually, you know, New Mexico is an incredibly poor state. We have a lot of problems. Luckily, we stayed a blue state this year or this last election, but I have a feeling that we kind of would have been left behind in a lot of our a lot of the problems that we have now would be a lot worse if we hadn't stayed part of the Union. It's kind of a frightening prospect, even though I would like to see a lot of the southern states go, in theory.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a,
well,
kind
that's,
of a difficult
that's,
thing to...
This is the conversation that, like I said, you know, Louise and I have been having this conversation for a decade or longer, and she's not, you know, absolutely, get rid of them all. Because, you know, we lived in Atlanta for 13 years. Which would have been probably the capital of the Deep South or close to it, you know, maybe the industrial capital of the Deep South. And, she's not totally get rid of them. And what we get is that there's a lot of really good and decent people living in the South, and we can't just abandon them. And on the other hand, you've got the Republicans who are, you know, 44% of self-described Republicans believed an armed revolution might be necessary to protect our liberties. It's been, I remember the year after Obama was elected president, I went into a gun shop in Mason, Michigan with my brother Steve and I think with my brother John and his son and Louise. And, you know, we were going to do some shooting practice range that they've got there, and my brother had a new 40 caliber, I think it was a Ruger, whatever it was that, you know, I wanted to try it out. And the guy was like, you know, we've two boxes, that's it. You know, we'll only sell you two boxes of ammunition, a total limit. And I'm like, why? And he says, because of that N-word in the White House. I mean, he just came right out and said it.
Oh.
And it's like, it's been going on ever since. I mean, it's just, there's just this constant churn of these right-wing emails. Just, you know, it's this, and this was in Michigan, which would have been one of the northern states. But
it's like, terrifying for somebody like me. I actually, not only am I a native southern state, I'm a Latina, and I also work for a government-funded organization. Mm. And to, you know, just come out and say, like, we need to take up arms against people who are teachers, people who, you know, will run into a burning building to save your life. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. And sometimes I wonder if these people really believe what they're saying, or if they're, they, you know, not to sound paranoid, but if they have kind of a different agenda. I don't know if it's being driven by money or if it's being driven by just pure hatred.
It's being driven by fear, Natalie. Here's what's going on. When Reagan came into office, we had a country where we had a good, solid middle class. The average CEO only made 30 times what the average worker made. Most of the businesses in your town were owned by families in your town, and most of the workers knew the people who owned the company that they worked for when Ronald Reagan came into office. And if you're not old enough to remember, ask somebody who is, and they'll tell you. I'm telling you the truth here. And young people don't even, you know, they can't even imagine this. And 32 years of Reaganomics has devastated America. It's just devastated America. We've seen the average individual income go from what would be in today's dollars around $40,000 a year down to $25,000 a year. Household incomes have remained the same, but only because, you know, women have gone to work because, you know, we now have two worker households rather than one. So that's the way that Americans have kind of held their heads, you know, just at the waterline. So they know that something's wrong. They know that the country's gone to hell in a handbasket. They know that the local businesses are no longer owned by anybody local. Nobody's going to answer their complaints if they try to, you know, call up or go to the bank or go to the, you know, clothing store or whatever, you know, with a concern or a complaint or a refund or anything. You know, they're going to get laughed at if they try to call a telephone number they could put on hold forever and you know, please dial zero for, you know, but they don't know why. They're frightened. They're afraid that their country doesn't work, and then along come the demagogues. Then along come the billionaires who want to keep their billions, thank you very much, who want to keep their tax breaks, you know, the Mitt Romney tax class, the Mitt Romney Paris Hilton tax break, that, you know, maximum 20% income tax on capital gains, the big corporations that pay no income taxes at all on hundreds of billions of dollars in profits. And they come along and they say to these folks, hey, you know what the problem is? It's those pointy-headed liberals. It's the nanny state. It's that guy on welfare. It's that black woman in Harlem who drives a Cadillac to pick up her welfare check. It's that black guy in the White House. It's the people who want to take away it's those gay people. I mean, depending on who they're talking to, they figure out some way to say these are the ones who have screwed up everything. And people know in their guts that, you know, in the last 32 years, this country has fallen, you know, has really fallen apart in many ways. And these demagogues are giving them, you know, people to point to and say, oh, it's them. It's the Latinos and Latinas. It's the, you know, the people who, people with the, you know, a non-European ancestry, or people who have darker skin, or people who speak Spanish. It's people who are government employees, you know, they got unions, they make more money. It's people, and Natalie, like you're describing yourself. And that's scary stuff. You think I might be right, Natalie?
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for the call. And you know, what we've got to do is we've got to reach out to these people. We've got to wake up these people. We've got to let them know that we have a 33-year failed experiment called Reaganomics in this country, and it's time to roll it back. We need to go back to the New Deal.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And when people once again have decent paying jobs and decent pensions and a decent retirement and decent health care and their kids can get an education, then I think the crazies are going to go away. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Boy, Kelly Ayotte, she's the entire, you know, the governor and both senators from New Hampshire are women, but she's the Republican and the freshman, and she sold out her state by saying, nah, we're not going to background check terrorists and crazy people and wife beaters. Nah, not going to do that. And she hadn't even had a chance to take any money from the IRA. I think she was just hoping to. What did I say? IRA? NRA. Yeah. no, I'm not going to go there. Okay. And ABC News now calling her out for misleading on background checks. This is interesting because she's doing town halls across New Hampshire. Now, you have to give her props for that, right? You really do. A lot of these people, particularly the Republicans, they go back to their home states and they just hide in their mansions. Or they go off to, you know, some island, some, you know, they go to the Grand Caymans and visit their money. But Kelly Ayotte has gone back to New Hampshire and she's visited with the people of the great of the Granite State. I lived in New Hampshire for 5 years. I know New Hampshire quite well. And during a town hall in Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire, I've been through Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire. Somebody asked her, you know, why did you vote against this registry? It's not even a registry. Why did you vote against background checks that would prevent crazy people who have been adjudicated with a history of violence? Because, I mean, I'm not talking about people who are under the care of a psychiatrist or are depressed or you know, something like that. But I'm talking about genuinely violent, crazy people. It would stop violent people who are mentally ill and would stop criminals and would stop terrorists from buying guns at gun shows. Because right now, you know, you have to go through a background check if you buy a gun from a licensed registered gun dealer. But if you go to a gun show, all bets are off. And the first couple times people asked her this, in fact, a woman who lives in New Hampshire, whose mother was the principal of the school in Newtown, got gunned down by that kid with the AR-15. A couple days ago, stood up and asked Kelly Ayotte, you know, okay, you're all worried about the inconvenience to the store owners of having to, you know, call a number or check on a computer and punch in somebody's name and address and see if the FBI has them on the terror watch list. What about the inconvenience to my mother of being murdered in her school? And Kelly Ayotte just basically said, change the subject. Well, people weren't taking that so well. So yesterday, she decided, you know, telling the truth, which, I mean, she just didn't have any truth to tell. She voted against another bill that would have provided equal pay for equal work for women. And when she was asked, why'd you vote against that? She said, well, we already have too many laws. Right. Yeah, let's get rid of some of those laws. We got too many laws. Let's get rid of the laws against bank robbery. Let's get rid of the laws against speeding. There's some laws I'd actually like to get rid of. I think that our drug laws are misguided. But in any case, she didn't vote for that because I don't think that she thought that that would work all that well. So she just kind of changed. So now she's resorted to lying. She said, that she voted against this because she was trying to protect gun show owners. This is what she first said, gun shop owners, from, you know, an unnecessary burden. But during this town hall in Fitzwilliam, I offered an additional reason. I'm reading from the Center for American Progress's Think Progress book, for killing the popular measure and said falsely that it would lead to the creation of a national registry. The law actually explicitly said there cannot be a registry. You would have to pass a law to undo this law before you could create a registry. So she said, oh, well, you know, this is going to lead to a national registry of guns. We can't have that. And at that point, somebody from the press stood up and said words to the effect of liar, liar, pants on fire. I'm sure they phrased it differently. I'm sure it was, you know, like, excuse me, the bill says the opposite of that. She was then spirited away by her aides before reporters could ask about her claim. When asked by ABC News whether she believed her vote was being mischaracterized, she said yes. Mischaracterized. Wait a minute. You voted no on background checks. How do you mischaracterize that? You mean they're saying that you voted yes? I don't think so. But 44% of self-identified Republicans think that there's going to be an armed revolution that, well, to quote the question correctly, quote, an armed revolution might be necessary to protect our liberties. Bill in Snowmass Village, Colorado. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, I want to talk about how big the government should be.
Yes, sir.
You know, I don't really care how big it should be, if it's big or small. What I care about is how effective it is. And that's really what it comes down to, and I think a lot of what you were talking about.
I agree. That's very, very well said. And in fact, the big small argument is kind of playing into the hands of the billionaires who and the Reaganites who, you know, government is not here to help you. Government is the cause of your problems, et cetera, who would like to replace government with big corporations. Excellent point, Bill. Thank you for calling and making it. Linda in Mattawan, New Jersey, listening on WWRL in New York City. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just a reflection of what the gentleman just said, because I feel that they're not engaged. It's been a big dog and pony show for years, and they focus on all the things like gay marriage and this, that, and the other thing, rather than focusing in on, you know, what people need, which are jobs.
Yeah.
And instead of them making, you know, sure that we do have jobs and ending NAFTA and things like that, they focus on everything but.
Yep.
And America, like you said, is going down the drain rapidly, and there is no recourse.
Well, we can repudiate Reaganomics and go back to the New Deal and the Great Society and have a society that works. I mean, you know, I agree. It's having government that actually, you know, that represents the people. And by the way, during the times when capitalism fails, and capitalism does fail periodically, it's a cyclical thing, and it's just, you know, it's called the business cycle. You know, anybody who knows anything about capitalism has read about the business cycle, knows about the business cycle. When the business cycle fails, that's when government needs to get bigger so that it can step in and be the employer of last resort and keep people working so they have money in their pockets, so they continue to buy things, so there continues to be demand. And then when when capitalism is humming along and free enterprise and everybody has a job, then government can get a whole lot smaller, and it doesn't need to be doing WPA and CCC kind of things. And so I don't think that that there is any arbitrary number. I think it's a matter of being effective. Excellent. Excellent point, Linda. Thank you for calling and making it. Wayne, listening to WHMP in Granby, Massachusetts. Hey, Wayne, what's up?
Hi, Tom. My comment was about the size of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that perhaps Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft must be spinning in their graves over the rebuilding of all the monopolies in the world? We've gone from 10 airlines to one or two.
Yeah, and these guys were Republicans, by the way. Let us not forget.
Oh, yeah, and of course the service is going to be that much better, right? And the prices will go down. Ha, ha, ha.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I think Teddy Roosevelt and William Howard Taft are spinning in their graves. I think that they would not recognize the Republican Party of today. I think they'd be horrified. They themselves were horrified by the sellouts within their party. And, you know, to tell the truth, at that time, back in during the progressive era, it was the Republicans who were holding the standard more than the Democrats, more often than not, right around the turn of the century. It shifted, you know, after World War I, but excellent point. Wayne, thanks for the call. Nick, listening to TuneIn Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. We've got a minute to the break. Quick one.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say really quickly, I grew up in Utah most of my life, and I just wanted to say that you've made a comment a couple times about until the 1980s, the Mormon Church had a race rule. And I just wanted to say that their belief that backed that idea never disappeared, and they have never apologized for it.
Hmm.
They still firmly believe that Africans are descendants of Cain, and they still hold the curse.
Wow.
They just made an exception because everybody was getting upset at them. They made an exception saying, oh, well, God told us that it's okay now. God told us that they can be part of our church now.
Yeah. Well, that's sad. Nick, thank you for the call. I mean, again, we can't indict an entire religion because of a small group of crazies. I don't know if this is a small group or a large group, though. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
44% of Republicans. Really? Armed revolution? Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. And Steve, listening on WCPT in River Forest, Illinois. Hey, Steve, what's up? Government size?
In reference to that question about how large the government should be, I think it should be at least as large as the country which has the highest standard of living. And if I'm not mistaken, I think that's Finland, and its government or the public sector is about 40% of GDP.
It's Denmark, and the government sector is closer to 60% of GDP. It's
wow.
Quite substantial, yeah, because they have the Danish radio. We did our show from the Danish radio studios. They pretty much have their own broadcasting network. It's a small country, a lot of subsidized housing, excellent public transportation. I believe that the government owns the water and power systems. And, of course, education is free all the way through college. In fact, you get a stipend. You get paid to go to college. They have trade schools. They have a relatively small military, but they do have one. It's been a while since I've looked at a chart. I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure it's over 50%. So anyhow, Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us. To the Talk Radio News Report brought to you, of course, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of the goat and the slave that you helped. And probably Ellen will be the one who took the picture because this is her charity. Ellen, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. And very interesting. Today, Ed Markey, turns out there was a poll done. This is a Massachusetts race. Gabriel Gomez is a businessman, went to Annapolis. Markey is only 6 points ahead of him. And Markey's a Democrat. This is something that we need to pay attention to as a country and as your radio program.
And do you think that Gomez having a Hispanic name might have something to do with that?
Perhaps. But, you know, Massachusetts has often elected Republican governors. They kind of like this independent free spirit.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mitt Romney was the... He was the last Republican, wasn't he, who was governor?
Right.
I mean, you have a house in Massachusetts.
But that wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That was,
Okay. I am in New York City today, and the spire on the World Trade Center went up. It looks quite amazing. It's 776 feet. It makes the whole building the third tallest in the world, obviously a symbolic number that they chose. 758 tons it weighs. 408 feet, of course, without that, it's not the third tallest building in the world, but. Okay, the president nominated Penny Pritzker today. As you know, there are some problems with the Superior Bank. Uninsured are still owed $10 million. The FDIC had to bail it out to the point of $300 million. Just truth and honesty, Penny Pritzker is my cousin's niece.
Uh-huh. Okay. But is the, you mentioned a bank. Does she own the bank or something? Is she affiliated with
it? The family owned the Superior Bank.
I see.
Bailed out by the feds.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Right.
So she was nominated to be what?
She is nominated to be the Commerce Secretary.
Uh-huh.
Often a political appointment.
You know, I've actually... this is Penny Pritzker from Chicago, right?
Right.
Yeah. I've heard reasonably good things about her, that she's...
Well, she's a pretty amazing person. But... do not be surprised if there isn't some grief from the Republicans on those two issues.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, now this is disturbing to you and me and Louise and all of us who follow mental health. The CDC announced a report today that the suicide rate has increased 28% in the last decade among white men and women 35 to 64. It is the age group with the that holds 57% of suicides. Now, that's everybody, black, white, et cetera, but that age group, 35 to 64, and that the West and South had the biggest rates, first by guns, second by hanging, third by overdose. And of course, part of the analysis may be the economic issue.
Here's something that you should Google, Ellen, when you get a chance. This was in the September 18th, 2002, BBC News World Edition. The headline, More Suicides Under Conservative Rule. And it was an analysis they did of the UK and Australia from 1901 to 1998. And they said the figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative state and federal governments were in power. And I'll just give you the very last, the way they wrapped it up. Overall, they say the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the conservatives not been in power, equivalent to one suicide for every day of the 20th century, or two for every day that the conservatives ruled. And this is a BBC news story.
So, wow.
Yeah. So I'd say, 32 years of Reaganomics, suicide rate is up. Makes perfect sense to me.
Wow, that is pretty wild.
Yeah.
Okay. Some other things that are going on. Today, the president, of course, is in Mexico. He's going to be meeting with President Calderon probably as we speak now, then doing a press conference. Three issues, of course, are immigration, trade, and drugs. And then they're going to be having a working dinner. Probably is not, they're only meeting for like an hour and 5 minutes before the press conference, so they're probably deciding what they're going to say on that.
Mm-hmm.
The Benghazi attacks are very interesting. They are now showing some photographs of some people. They're saying there were three people on the ground during this, and they are looking for them to provide information. Secretary Hagel today did a press briefing today with the British, his British counterpart. They said they want an investigation on the chemical weapons. He was asked about arming the rebels, and he said we're in favor of exploring other options. And he also said that President Assad is no longer the legitimate leader of the Syrian people.
Hmm.
The other thing that the UK defense minister said is that both nations, the US and UK, face budget constraints, but they are going to continue to work to ensure that Afghanistan is not going to harbor terrorists. One wonders if there's going to be a payoff like it's just been revealed.
No, another suitcase full of cash on its way to Karzai, is that the deal?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Ellen, thank you so much. Oh, Ellen appears to have gone. We will be back, Ellen, right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The founder of Wahhabism, thank you for this, Connecticut, Muhammad Ibn Abd al-Wahhab, 1703 to 1792. Fascinating. And Howie Kurtz was fired? Maybe from the Daily Beast. I don't know. It's in the chat room. It may be true. It may not. I'm not gonna. In fact, I just lost the chat room. I think we've lost our internet. Yeah. Okay, so we've lost our live stream too. Okay, I want to go through Guantanamo by the numbers. I think this is a really, really interesting. This is put out by the ACLU, and it's. It is literally called Guantanamo by the numbers, and what it is, well, self-explanatory. The number of men imprisoned at Guantanamo by the Department of Defense since that prison opened on January 11th, 2002, I'm showing things are back up now, by the way. So I'm going to open the call screening software now. Okay. All right. Excuse me, we're having some internet problems here. The number of this is you know, it's amazing. I do this show all over the world, and it's like in Europe, in Asia, the internet software, the internet infrastructure is so good and works so solidly and is so stable and so reliable. And you have all these different countries competing, or you have large government subsidies that make these things happen. Here in the United States, we've got a duopoly. We've got basically two, three, four large corporations that control virtually all of the internet activity in the United States. And as a result, our service sucks. Anyhow, number of men imprisoned at Guantanamo by the Department of Defense since that prison opened on January 11, 2002, is 779. As of January of this year, there's still 166 people there from 23 countries. The total number of those 166 people who are actually serving sentences, because they had a trial, even though it was a military commission trial, three. Three people at Guantanamo because they were convicted of something. The number of people who are still imprisoned at Guantanamo after being cleared for release by the government back in 2009, this is 2013, is 86. 46 is the number of prisoners the U.S. has said it lacks evidence to prosecute, but says are too dangerous to release. If you have no evidence to prosecute them, how do you know they're too dangerous to release? Oh, we just know. So the conservatives say, well, you know, at least they're down there where it's cheap. You don't want to stick them in the prisons here. That would cost a fortune, right? Well, here's what it costs per year to imprison the 86 men who have been cleared for release. $69 million a year. If you think these guys are dangerous, give them each $600,000 a year and let them resettle in, you know, get them a nice apartment in Bangkok or something. It's like, you know, put them in some place that's a tourist paradise and they'll just, you know, or a big Disney World, you know, get them a condo in Disney outside of Disney World. By the way, if those 86 men who have been cleared for release had been moved into federal prisons, instead of us paying $69 million a year to take care of them, it would have cost $3 million a year. Guantanamo is really expensive. The percentage of people who have been who are prisoners at Guantanamo who were never Al-Qaeda fighters, according to U.S. government data, 92%. 92% of these people were never actually fighting against us. The Bush administration released 532 of them. The Obama administration has released 72 of them. The youngest prisoner at Guantanamo was 13 years old. The oldest prisoner at Guantanamo was 98 years old. The number of children that we have imprisoned in Guantanamo, this is why this is a stain on this country. The number of children that we have imprisoned at Guantanamo is 21. The number of FBI agents who have each independently reported that they have seen abusive treatment of Guantanamo prisoners. The number of FBI agents who have gone out of their way to say, I have seen abusive treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo, more than 200. The number of prisoners who have been tortured in secret CIA prisons overseas before they came to Guantanamo, at least 26 of them. Nine of them. Keep in mind, only three of the people in Guantanamo have ever been tried and convicted. Nine have committed suicide. Nine have died in custody. Seven of suicide, one from a heart attack, and one from cancer. The youngest to have died by suicide, a fellow by the name of Yasser Talal al-Zahrani, who was captured at the age of 16 and committed suicide at the age of 21. Now, where did these people who are in Guantanamo come from? Only 5% of them were captured by American troops. Percent of them are there because somebody responded to a bounty offer This is a quote from the bounty offer. To Pakistani and Afghan villagers to turn someone in. We will provide you with millions of dollars, enough money to take care of your family, your village, your tribe for the rest of your life. So what do? They turn in the guy who's the village crank, the guy who nobody likes, the guy who was, you know, sleeping with your sister-in-law. I mean, you know, whatever it may be. I mean, it's Ralph. He's the guy. Get him. This is incredible. The number of Guantanamo prisoners that have been transferred for prosecution to federal court, 1. The number of military prosecutors who have said, we would like to be reassigned, or I am quitting this job because these military commissions are unjust. That word, unjust. 7. 7 military prosecutors have said, get me out of here. The prosecutors. Because this is the wrong thing to do. Just since 2011, we've spent $12 million on these military commissions. We have 7 convictions by these military commissions, 5 of them through plea deals, 1 in a contested trial. 1 defendant chose not to participate in his own trial. 4 of those convicted have already been transferred home, and 3 have been released. Barack Obama, President Obama was right. You know, Guantanamo is a stain on America. It is a major stain on America. What are we going to do about that? Don't know. We do need to do something about it, though. Well, actually, don't know. We need to close Guantanamo. It's really simple. We need to send people back to the countries that will take them. We need to, those people that we have any basis to believe are criminals, try them in a criminal court. And frankly, I think we need to be paying reparations to the people who are just there because somebody wanted a bounty. It's crazy that we were offering bounties in the first place. You go to a poor country and say, I'll give you millions.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is how poorly run this so-called war on terror was by the criminals running the Bush administration. It's insane. Welcome back. It's Thursday, so let's get geeky on going environmental or not. Perhaps not shockingly, a new series of studies reveals that conservatives are less likely to buy energy-efficient light bulbs if they're packaged or marketed as, quote, environmentally friendly, end quote. In one of the studies, liberal and conservative study participants were given $2 to spend on a light bulb and had to choose between a 50-cent incandescent bulb and a buck-and-a-half compact fluorescent bulb. The compact fluorescent bulb cost more but was far more energy-efficient. All the participants were told that the CFL bulb, compact fluorescent bulb, would last 9,000 more hours and reduce energy costs by 75% compared to the regular incandescent bulb. In other words, it made sense to buy it. Now, both liberal and conservative study members chose the energy-efficient CFL bulb, but here's where it gets interesting. If the CFL bulb was labeled with a sticker that said protect the environment, those who identified themselves as politically moderate or conservative were actually less likely to buy that light bulb. Dana Gromit, lead author of the study from the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, said of the study that, quote, I think we've shown the negative consequences of environmental messaging. In particular, you can lose significant portions of people who would otherwise be interested in these products when you use an environmental labeling. So it indicates that different messages can reach different groups. End quote. So what's the study really telling us? Well, if you want conservatives to finally start caring about the environment and begin taking the actions needed to curb climate change, then just throw away the environmentally friendly labels and replace them with big energy guzzler labels instead. That's what they should do. They should manufacture, you know, the same LED or CFL light bulb, and they should have one package, you know, nice green packaging that says good for the environment, you know, $5.25. Then they should have another one that says, you know, not so good for the environment. Beware, contains mercury. Doesn't, you know, burns electricity. You know, will pollute the atmosphere, and charge an extra buck. The conservatives will buy that one, right? Jim says the SUV of light bulbs. Yes, that exactly. That's what we need to do. That's what we need to do. Oh my goodness, it is. Is it 23 minutes after the hour 5 o'clock? It is okay. 5:23. In that case, Hessel in San Gabriel, California. Hey, Hessel, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I think your show is great, and I just discovered you a couple months back with your interview with David Duke, and I'm glad you told him how it was.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Oh yeah, I was calling you about like this whole Guantanamo Bay issue that you were just talking about. I just called right now, and you know, just Weissman has been closed, and you know, and you always see these conservatives defending it. You know, particularly the Chicken Hawks, who are always defending it and how it's great and how we should, you know, torture these prisoners for what they do. But really, it's just adding to our costs to our budget. I'm not sure what the expenditures are. I don't have the figures or anything, but yeah.
It's costing a small fortune. I can tell you that. I can tell you that the cost. There is one comparison in here, millions of dollars. Here it is. The amount it costs per year to imprison at Guantanamo the 86 men who have been cleared for release. They were cleared for release in 2009. Is $69 million a year. If those people were held in federal prisons in the United States, it would be $3 million. So you can extrapolate from that, you know, all the other costs. So, yeah, you're absolutely right, Hessel. It is crazy. It is absolutely crazy. Thanks for the call. Dave in Mount Prospect, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I enjoyed your response to the guy who said, well, how big do you liberals want government to be? I thought it was right on point. Now I think it's time to find that guy or one of his buddies and turn the question around. How small do you want government to be, and how do you want to get there? I'd love to hear the answer.
Excuse me. I have had libertarians on this program actually suggest that all roads should be privately owned, that as soon as you pull out of your driveway, you should have to pay a toll to somebody. Somebody should be making a buck on the road, and that all fire departments should be privately owned, and if you don't pay for the use of, you know, if you don't pay every year the fee to the fire department, then they should let your house burn down. That private police departments work better than public police departments because some gated communities have them, you know, security guards and things. And, you know, maybe in a world of billionaires that would work. I don't know. But there are libertarians out there who, and a lot of them actually, who believe that there is virtually nothing other than maybe a court system to protect people against fraud, and maybe an army to protect our borders. That's it. Everything else should be privatized. So that's what
scary.
They were. Pardon?
I said that's scary.
Yeah, it is. It is. But they and then you ask them, okay, please tell me any country in the history of the world where this has worked. And they go, well, it's never worked out, you know, we've never been able to do it. Now, someday we will, maybe here, you know, it's if the Koch brothers get their way. No, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. Thanks a lot for the call, Dave. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Okay, Tom. Well, minute. Okay, I'll talk a little quick. With the three major religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the common thread is that they're all messianic.
Actually, Judaism is not.
No, Judaism is, because if you...
Oh, you're right. You're right. It is messianic. It is not evangelical. I'm sorry. I misunderstood you.
Christianity, they say Jesus has already come in. They're waiting for his coming back. In
right.
Islam, they're waiting for the Messiah in the nature of something. I'm not really quite sure.
Yeah.
But in Islam, Jesus is considered a prophet. In the Old Testament, Abraham is ready to sacrifice Isaac, and in the Quran, Abraham is ready to sacrifice Ishmael. You know, so there's so many common threads. Now, if you talk about Muslims killing Muslims, you have a lot of people too. Christians killing Christians. Look at the British under Cromwell when they had the whole the whole Reign of Terror,
yep.
which had people immigrating here. Those were our Puritans.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing how ignorant everyone is in terms of religion, and I think it ought to be some kind of a mandatory thing where just people have to.
Well, this is why I think we should teach comparative religion in our schools so the kids understand the nature of religion. And then they can choose. I mean, what they want to do. Thanks, Mark, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I would add that, you know, messianic religions tend to lead to messianic thinking. The someone will save us thinking, therefore if we just elect the right president, everything will be perfect. It doesn't quite work that way. The bad and the very, very peristrophically ugly. The good. Pope Francis I, speaking to a private mass at the Vatican yesterday, the new pontiff compared the conditions of factory workers in the third world to slave labor and called the exploitation of workers an affront to God. Referencing last week's garment factory collapse in Bangladesh, he said, "A headline that really struck me on the day of the tragedy in Bangladesh was living on 38 euros a month. This is what the people who died were being paid. This is called slave labor. Today in the world, this slavery is being committed against something beautiful that God has given us, the capacity to create, to work, to have dignity. How many brothers and sisters find themselves in this situation? Not paying fairly, not giving a job because you're only looking at balance sheets, only looking at how to make a profit. That goes against God." End of quote from Pope Francis I. During his time as the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Francis was known as a friend of the poor and a defender of the oppressed. If yesterday's remarks are any indication, it looks as though he'll continue that role as the Bishop of Rome. The bad. Barry West. West, the country commissioner for Coffee County, Tennessee, has found himself in Louis Gohmert-like hot water this week after posting a picture to his Facebook page over the weekend. It's titled, "How to Wink at a Muslim," and it's a picture of him holding a shotgun at you. Nice. West's offensive post is just the most recent in a slew of Islamophobic incidents in Tennessee over the past few years. In Murfreesboro, just up I-24 from Coffee County, arsonists burned down a local Islamic center in 2010 that had been the target of vandals and far-right protests for months. And in 2011, the volunteer state legislature passed a law banning Sharia law. In an interview with the local paper, Commissioner West said he didn't mean any harm by posting the image and that he just wants everybody to play by the same rules. I don't know what rules are playing by, Barry, but I'm pretty sure that posting pictures threatening violence against a whole community is just about the worst thing to do when you're a public servant. And the very, very ugly Pepsi. The beverage company is under fire for releasing a series of racist and misogynist advertisements for its soda brand Mountain Dew. Here's the most offensive.
"All right, man, we got them all lined up. Nail this little sucker. Come on, which one is he? Point to him."
"It's me. You should have gave me some more. I'm nasty.
I don't think I can do this."
"It's easy. Just point to him."
"You better not snitch on a player."
"No.
He's wearing the do-rag."
"Snitches get stitches, fool."
"Come on, and the one with the four legs.
That's gonna catch me.
Wow. Pepsi pulled the ad, but I think it's safe to say that everything about that commercial, especially the fact that Pepsi actually approved it for distribution, is just very, very ugly. For those of you who couldn't see it on TV, it was a goat and a bunch of black guys in a lineup. You know, with a woman who had been beaten up. I mean, it was just bizarre. Whoever came up with that idea should have been fired. And might well have been. Joe in Chicago Heights, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to see if you had seen the business news announcement about Apple Corporation and how it's
buying back
what's wrong.
Yeah, they're buying back their stock like crazy. They've got billions of dollars, a lot of it overseas, offshore. I'm guessing that this is a way to avoid paying taxes on it.
Crazy thing. They issued a $17 billion of bonds to borrow $17 billion
right.
when they have $145 billion of cash.
Right.
And the reason why they borrowed the money is because most of the cash is overseas.
Yep.
So to use it, they'd have to pay taxes.
Yep.
And with interest rates low, it's cheaper for them to borrow $17 billion, and then they can also deduct the interest that they have to pay on that.
Right. So you and I pay for the interest because they deduct it from their taxes.
Right. And all this money is not going to go into product development. It's going to shore up shareholder profit.
Yep. Yep. This is Apple doing the old banking thing. This is, yep, yeah, you're absolutely right, and that's a very good characterization of it, Joe, or at least one of the better, cleaner, easier-to-understand ones that I've come across. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WCPT. Mike in Neskonset, New York. Do I have that right, Mike?
Yes, sir.
Hey, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Thank you, yes. Tom, I was just calling regarding your conversations with callers about the size of government, and it should be much, much smaller. I think you're
then what?
A little bit extreme than what it is now. I mean,
okay. Which what part of government do you want to get rid of or shrink?
I'm sorry?
What part of government do you want to get rid of or shrink?
Well, really, a lot of what our federal government is involved in should be left at the local levels. You constantly bring up fire, police, education.
Right.
These are things for cities, states, local communities to take care of.
Okay.
The federal government.
So what you're saying is, I mean, because we have a situation right now where you've got mostly Republican red states that, for every dollar they send to Washington D.C., they get back $1.10, $1.20, $1.30, and mostly blue Democratic states, for every dollar they send to Washington D.C., they get back 70, 80 cents. And the reason for that. Well, is because we as a nation have decided that if somebody is born in poor rural West Virginia or Mississippi, that they shouldn't have to go to a crappy school just because they live in a poor neighborhood, and that they should have at the very least some minimum quality of education that is not that dissimilar from what somebody living in, you know, a wealthy suburb of San Francisco or New York would have. You're of the opinion that if somebody is unlucky enough to be born in a poor area, just to hell with them, right?
No, I'm saying that money should not be going to Washington to begin with. Much of that money, not that nothing should be going to Washington, obviously, but much of that should be left in the local states to fund these schools, to provide for these schools.
But West Virginia doesn't have the money. You've got communities, you've got counties in this country where you've got unemployment rates that are over 50%.
Well,
now, where are you going to get the money to have a school? How are you going to break people out of that kind of poverty?
Tom, you get your property taxes, you get your income taxes, all at the local level, okay?
And people who don't have jobs.
Just because you have a good idea for the federal government doesn't mean that it should be done. You know, there are a lot of
Mike, I think you don't understand how this works.
Yeah, I do. We have a constitution with enumerated powers. If you want them to do more, ask amendments.
Okay, so what is the very first enumerated power?
I'm sorry?
What's the very first enumerated power? Article 1, Section 8, Sentence 1 of the Constitution, the first of the enumerated powers. What is it?
I got to be honest with you. I don't have it in front of me.
Well, let me read it to you. Okay?
We
can have a conversation about this. Article 1, Section 8, these are, in fact, it's titled Powers Granted to Congress. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay for the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Now, tell me how somebody being born in poor rural West Virginia, where you in a county with a 50% unemployment rate, and basically no money to fund education, how their welfare, the general welfare of that county, is not at risk.
Okay, first of all, welfare is not an open-ended clause. Okay, there is still you can't do anything you want and call it welfare. Okay, even though it may be a good idea, you can't just do it. There are still rules of what you can and can't fund. Now, you know, my heart bleeds for certain people, but you know what? You could move. You could move to a place where there are better jobs, where you could earn more money, and go to a better school. Personally, I think there should
be if you had enough money. Well, okay, since we're discussing the term welfare, okay, in the Constitution, you know, one of the guys who was at the Constitutional Convention was Alexander Hamilton. You're familiar with Alexander Hamilton, first Secretary of the Treasury. He was one of the two delegates from New York State. In fact, he gave one of the opening speeches on the first day of a Constitutional Convention. This is what Alexander Hamilton had to say about the term general welfare. And this is from his report on manufacturers to Congress in 1793 when he was Secretary of the Treasury. Quote, the terms general welfare were intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded. Otherwise, numerous exigencies incident to the affairs of a nation could have been left without a provision. The phrase is as comprehensive as any that could have been used because it was not fit that the constitutional authority of the Union to appropriate its revenue should have been restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare, and because this necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are susceptible neither of specification nor of definition. It is therefore of necessity left to the discretion of the national legislature to pronounce upon the objects which concern the general welfare and for which, under that description, an appropriation of money is requisite and proper. And it seems to be no room for a doubt that whatever concerns the general interests of learning, of agriculture, of manufacture, and of commerce are within the sphere of the National Council as regards general welfare.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Mike, I just got stepped on myself. I'm sorry. We'll have to continue this conversation another time. 46 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, Chuck, in Rio Rico, Arizona. Hey, Chuck, what's up? Thanks for watching us on Dish TV Network on Free Speech TV.
Oh, thank you, Tom. I just wanted to relate a story that my dad told me when he was a serviceman in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he hung out with a lot of Muslim Egyptians.
Mm-hmm.
And he got to be friends with them. One day, you know, a guy invited him over for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
So he went, and you know, they drink tea, and after three cups of tea, my dad was getting up to leave, because that's usually the time period that you're allowed in a either Egyptian or a Muslim deal. After three cups of tea, it's time for you to leave. So he was leaving, and the guy says, why are you leaving? He said, well, I'm finished my third cup of tea, that's the custom here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guy said, no, since you were honorable enough to respect our ways, you stay. And then they also invited him to a wedding.
Wow.
It's not the problem. Muslims are not the problem if you respect their customs.
Yeah.
You'll find out that, because I'm Christian or Catholic, I was raised Catholic, and mm-hmm. if you respect and learn about their customs, there'd be a lot less trouble. That's all I want to say about that.
Well, you said it very well, Chuck, and I totally agree with you. And every religion is, I mean, we talk about religions in these kind of very abstract terms. They're people. I mean, these are people who hold certain beliefs and certain, you know, worldviews and whatever, but they're people, and people generally are pretty decent. And I agree with the earlier, thank you, Chuck, for the call. I agree with the earlier caller who said that the problem that we have with, quote, Muslim terrorism that the United States has and Canada doesn't have is blowback. It's blowback. It's 80 years of foreign policy and basically energy policy that has produced this consequence. Carl in Polson, Montana, listening to the AM760.com web stream. Hey, Carl, what's up?
I wanted to kind of contribute to the conversation you were having with the gentleman about welfare.
Mm-hmm.
He was talking, I think, in terms of welfare as in food stamps and all that icky stuff we give to people. And that's not what the Founding Fathers meant. They called it the welfare, the common good. It's the well-being of our nation, and we are the nation. And we ultimately, by electing our representatives, make the decision as to what that common good is, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, The next sentence, which I didn't have an opportunity to read in Hamilton's little rant about the phrase general welfare, because he's saying that basically what he was arguing was that a new manufacturing policy could be put into place, into law, under the enumerated powers of the Constitution by using the power of general welfare, which is the first of the enumerated powers. He said the only qualification of the generality of the phrase in question, general welfare, which seems to be admissible, is this: that the object to which an appropriation of money is to be made be general and not local, its operation extending, in fact or by possibility, throughout the union and not being confined to a particular spot. And so, you know,
I think I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's saying, you know, basically the federal government should do federal programs and or at least equalize things among the states so that as a nation we have a national standard. And that's how it's been interpreted. That's how it's been used. And, Carl, I think you're right. I think that for some reason the fellow thought that welfare meant the check that you get if you're on disability or if you're, you know, out of work or whatever, and he probably just didn't understand. Travis in Kearney, Nebraska, says you disagree with me, Travis.
Yeah, I do. I think the government being way too big as it is part of the reason why we have a 7.6% unemployment rate right now. You got a lot of people
How does that work?
You got a lot of people kind of like myself, a small business owner, but we don't know what we're going to be paying for taxes. We don't know what we're going to have to kick out for this Obamacare. We're not going out. We're not trying to hire more people.
Yeah. Well, I'm a small business owner. I know it can be you have up times and you have down times. Here on this show, we've had some had to get some new equipment. We've had some expenses. I mean, this month I didn't take a paycheck. But there are times when you make sacrifices. There are other times when you do well. But the fact of the matter is that you and I as small business owners are really blessed, and we couldn't be running these small businesses if it weren't for the government, if it weren't for the public roads, if it wasn't for the public airways, if it wasn't for the public highways, if it wasn't for an air traffic control system, if it wasn't for a police and fires system that just, you know, takes care of us and looks out for us. I mean,
to some extent, yes. But, you know, I built my own business.
I did too.
I operate my business. If I don't get up and go to my business every day, then my business is not thrive.
Same here. Same here.
Yeah. So to say that.
But wouldn't it be nice, Travis? You know, I'm paying. I don't know. Do you pay for the health insurance of your employees?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so do I. And you and I are paying around, probably on average, around between $8,000 and $10,000 a year per employee as a just as an additional cost to having an employee. So whatever you're paying that employee, add another $10,000. That's about what it costs us, to it. And if we lived in Canada, it would be less than half that. If we lived anywhere else in Europe, it would be a third that. Now, that's because the government is bigger in those countries. It's big enough to say, now, Stephen J. Hemsley, the guy who runs United Healthcare and who made a couple hundred million bucks last year, you can't do that. You can't make money ripping people off on on healthcare, skimming money off the top on healthcare. It's got to be part of the commons.
When you have Canadians coming across the border, though, the United States have procedures done. The
no, actually, you have Americans going across the border to Canada to buy drugs. Bernie Sanders organizes busloads of them. I used to live in Montpelier, Vermont. I'd see these people line up on Saturday to get on the bus to go up to Canada. I never, in the 10 years I lived in Vermont, saw a Canadian come to America for health care. And I had a couple good friends who were doctors in Montpelier. Never happened. Coming up tomorrow, speaking of Bernie Sanders, it's Friday. That means it's going to be Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our National Town Hall meeting. Plus, Town Hall Friday, anything goes Friday, whatever you want to talk about. And the news of the day, my thoughts on it, your comments on it. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something, tag your...
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.